Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening. Jordan
Compass. Hello and welcome to Mormon Stories. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and tonight I have the privilege to interview Jenny Brighton. She's a panelist over at Daughters of Mormonism podcast and a founder of the Amethyst Network, which is a miscarriage-specific support group that she started, that she'll be talking more about as we get into some of the things that she has as far as goals in mind of that. She has an undergraduate in theater education. She also has a little one that we can hear in the background. She has started her master's in psychology, and her own experiences with miscarriage have led her to want to be an advocate and an activist regarding miscarriage in general, and also in her pursuits of becoming a doula. So, with that in mind, hello, Jenny.
Hi.
Nice to talk with you. I understand that you are in Kotzebue, Alaska. Is that correct?
Kotzebue, yes.
Kotzebue, Alaska.
Yep, so. It's a little tiny town. We're just above the Arctic Circle, so we're way out here.
All right. Well, nice having you, and thank you for joining me tonight. Why don't we just dive in with some of your personal stories that maybe you want to share with us as far as providing the foundation for the rest of the things that we'll be speaking about today that hopefully will be more resource-oriented for those who either have experienced miscarriage or know people who have.
Okay. Well, I got into all of this because of my own experiences, so I'll start with just kind of a little bit of where I'm coming from. I am the oldest of nine children. I grew up, you know, being a little mommy to all of my younger siblings. That was what I always wanted. I always wanted to get married and have a bunch of kids. And when I was eight and nine, my mother had a couple of miscarriages, and I didn't understand a lot about it at the time. I knew that she was pregnant, and then something happened, and then she wasn't pregnant. But she went on to have other babies, and I didn't fully understand it. But that was my earliest introduction to, you know, what miscarriage was and the fact that it happened. When I was first married, we wanted to have kids right away. My husband had an older son from his first marriage, and so knowing that there was going to be a several-year gap there, we said, well, we would like to have a few more kids, and we'd like to get going right now to make that gap, you know, as small as we can. And so I got pregnant with a honeymoon baby, and we were really excited. And everybody says you don't tell during the first trimester. And so at, you know, 13 and a half weeks, when I was, you know, had finished the first trimester, we made the phone calls and the emails, and we were telling everybody, you know, we'd told our family, but we were telling everybody. And the next week I miscarried. It was really, I thought that you wait the first trimester because after the first trimester, then you don't miscarry anymore. I thought that we had waited long enough that we were in the clear. And so the idea that something could go wrong after the first trimester was just not something that I was familiar with. I thought that the first trimester was when you could miscarry, and then once you got to the middle trimester, it was free sailing. I guess I was very naive, but that was just all I had ever heard. So part of the awkwardness of miscarrying right exactly at that stage of having told everyone and then miscarrying the next week, I remember actually getting a congratulatory card in the mail a couple of days after the miscarriage. Mm-hmm. And that was, obviously it had been intended in a positive way, but it was a very, you know, it was sort of salt in the wound. It was a really painful thing. And I spent a lot of time in those first few days, especially a lot of time on the phone with my mom because she was the only person I knew that had miscarried. And I felt really alone. My husband was supportive of you, and we just were grieving differently. He had a lot of concern over me at that point because I had, that's a late enough stage that I had some very heavy bleeding associated with that miscarriage. I ended up spending several hours in the emergency room where they were making sure that I, you know, they, at one point they thought I was going to need a transfusion and that sort of thing. And so there was a lot of concern over me and my health. And so, you know, for my husband, he was very concerned about me, and so his grief for the baby wasn't, I guess, realized in the same way or to the extent that mine was. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, in the first trimester, the mother is the one with the primary connection to the baby because nobody else can see it or feel it or those kinds of things.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of went through that experience, which was physically really difficult and emotionally really difficult, and just trying to, you know, to reach out to find support and also, you know, still wanting to have babies. And so it was about, about 8 months later that I got pregnant again. And that time I said, well, whatever happens, you know, I'm not going to wait that 13 weeks to tell people. And so we told everybody right away, which I think was a good thing because that time I miscarried at 13 weeks. On Valentine's Day, I had an ultrasound and I went in and they couldn't find a heartbeat. And Valentine's night, I had a DNC.
Can you explain what a DNC is?
Yes. A DNC is a dilation and curettage, which is where they give you, I don't even know what they give you. They'll typically, you know, put you under, they can do it outpatient, but they'll put you under and they give you a drug to dilate the cervix. And then essentially they use a little vacuum to just clean everything out. And it's something that is done if, you know, if a woman has begun to miscarry, but maybe not everything's coming out and she just keeps bleeding and bleeding. But it's also something that's becoming more and more common if a miscarriage is diagnosed by ultrasound, but she has not actually begun to bleed yet, then they will just do the DNC and kind of clean everything out. And then she doesn't have to, you know, sit around waiting for it to happen, which is emotionally traumatic on a whole other level. I can say that for me personally, having done it both ways, I felt like I didn't really find the same kind of emotional closure when I had the DNC because with the first miscarriage, it was late enough that there was a little tiny baby. And, you know, he fit in the palm of my hand, but there was a little tiny baby to say goodbye to. And that helped me a lot emotionally, in spite of it, that one having been such a physically difficult loss.
So you got to hold your baby is what you're saying.
Yes, my first baby, I did get to hold him, and he was tiny, you know, but mm-hmm. but we held him and we named him, and that for me really helped. And with a DNC, there, you know, obviously there was not that option. So I mean, there's miscarriages are really different. My different experiences were very, very different from each other, and in a way, I think that's helpful for me because I learned that that every time is different and every experience is different, every woman is different, and that you can't really generalize from one experience to the next.
Which helps you in the sense of now becoming a resource for women, that you're not just mm-hmm. going off your one experience and assuming that most people have had that type mm-hmm. of an experience, is I'm assuming what you're saying.
Yeah.
Let me back up just a little bit to some of your history. You mentioned your mother had several miscarriages. I'm assuming, did you grow up Mormon? Did you grow up in the church?
Oh, yes, I did.
LDS? member, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, born and raised and members for several generations back on both sides.
Okay.
And so, very, polygamous pioneers and so on.
Okay. And when your mother... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we've been members for a long time.
Okay. And so when your mother went through these experiences and, you know, obviously as kids you knew she was pregnant and then she wasn't, was there a big kind of family sit down and to discuss about it, or was it more kind of quiet and not as much discussed, or what do you remember about that as a child?
When I was 8, my baby sister was 9 months old and she died from SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. And so the miscarriages followed in the year after that. And so we had, as a child, I mean, I remember the sit down that morning when my parents brought us in and told us that Amy had died. I don't specifically remember, discussions following the miscarriages. I remember lots of talking about how we knew that we were going to see Amy, in the millennium. The miscarriages, I don't remember ever discussing any of that kind of thing. I don't know how much my mother thought about it. I know that at least one of them was a later one and was very physically difficult, and the familial concern was over my mom's health more than anything else. Mm. But honestly, at 8 years old, it's, hey, we're going to have a baby, that's exciting, and oh, we're not, well, that's disappointing. And right. I think that was about as much as I really understood at that age. But when I was going through my own experiences, like I said, my mom was the only one I knew. And so I spent a lot of time talking to her, but even so, she had two experiences and I had two experiences, but they were different. And so she could relate to me on some things, but not on others.
Yeah, why don't you spend a little bit of time talking about that? Because that's, I think, nice that you were able to reach out to your mother at this time, right, and share. And then maybe at the same time, it was disappointing that maybe she didn't understand some of the things the way you saw them. Or can you at least speak to that experience as mother and daughter sharing these experiences together?
Well, I think... One of the biggest things was that for both of hers, I know they were very medically managed. It was the kind of thing where they knew that something was wrong. And in both cases, she went in, she had the DNC. The one time she had begun to hemorrhage. And so I don't know a lot of what, may have been involved in leading up to making the decision, or if it was sort of a, this is all we can do and we need to do it now. With my first miscarriage, I was almost 15 weeks pregnant, and one day I just started having these pains, which I now recognize as essentially having been early labor. Mm-hmm. But at the time I just thought, oh man, I ate something and it is not agreeing with me. Mm-hmm. But they lasted all day long and they were really bothering me, and I was really starting to get, I don't know what to do about this. And honestly, it was not until there was blood everywhere that I fully registered that this was a miscarriage.
And maybe I was in denial. Home?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was, I hadn't been feeling real good, and I thought maybe there's something to worry about. And I had an appointment with my midwife to go and get an ultrasound later in that week. I was going to go in a couple of days and we were just going to check and, check on things. And obviously there was not a need to do that because I miscarried at home. And so our decision to go to the emergency room was an after the fact kind of thing when the bleeding didn't stop.
And did you deliver your baby then at home or at the hospital or?
At home. Deliver seems like a strange word because it wasn't like I was very involved. It just sort of happened. Mm-hmm. It's different when they're very little.
Is there a better word?
Everything
you would
just
use?
Sort of comes out. No. I think deliver is probably right. I guess just thinking in relation to, the full term deliveries. It's not it's a similar process, but it's not exactly the same. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't pushing, I wasn't focusing in the same kinds of ways. It was, I had, and I think part of this, honestly, part of this has to do with that I was not aware of what was happening. I knew that I was experiencing pain. Like I said, I thought it was probably intestinal, but I was getting really tired of it. I didn't know why it wasn't going away. So I, you know, I didn't really know what was happening. And I think that that makes a huge difference with a miscarriage as opposed to a term delivery, is that when you're having a baby, you're dealing with, you know, the stress and pains of labor and delivery and all of those things, but they're a good thing. You know that they're supposed to be happening. And with a miscarriage, I think often, well, I don't know if it's often, but sometimes you don't know what's happening. I certainly didn't know what was happening until it was sort of in the thick of it. And whether you know what's happening or not, there's not going to be a baby to hold at the end of it. And so at least for me, it felt sort of purposeless. You know, I labored all day long with my first baby that I, you know, that did make it to term. And yet it was okay. I could deal with it because I knew that at the end there was going to be a baby. And yet with the miscarriages, you're having the contractions, you know, and yet there's not going to be, you know, a baby to hold at the end of it. And so there's grief with the pain, and there's probably shock and all of these other things sort of combine so that even though physically it might be very comparable to a delivery, emotionally it's really not.
Well, and I would add to that probably fear and even maybe some panic as mm-hmm. far as you're seeing blood and you're not supposed to be seeing blood. And
yes,
I'd imagine.
Especially when there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point you're not only worried for yourself or for your baby, but you're also worried for yourself, I would assume.
Yeah.
It's just gotta
be. I remember with that first miscarriage, and this was just before we decided to go to the hospital, I had climbed into the bathtub because there was kind of blood everywhere and I wanted to clean up me and get my clothes off and whatever. And I climbed into the bathtub to kind of wash up a little bit, and I remember feeling lightheaded, and so I kind of laid back, and I remember thinking, if I sit up, I am going to pass out. And if I pass out, I might not ever wake up. And I had this very lucid, very calm thought about it. I just thought, oh, that's going to be awful. My poor husband will be a widower. I just, you know, the kind of, and just then my husband walked in and he said, I think maybe we should go to the emergency room. And I said, yeah, I think we should, but you have to carry me. I can't stand up. And so, you know, he carried me out to the car, and we went to the emergency room, and they put, I don't even know what all they put into me. And, you know, I spent a couple days not doing very much, mostly in bed while my body sort of put itself back together. But yeah, it can be really, really scary when you're in the midst of it. And that was something else that a lot of people didn't relate to. You know, for the people that did know that I was pregnant, it was, oh, she's pregnant, oh, she's not. And the whole transition process was really foreign. You know, they were, people were sympathetic. They, you know, they would give me hugs and say, I'm sorry, but they didn't know what I needed, and I didn't know what I needed. I didn't know what to tell them that I needed. I didn't know what would be helpful for me or how they could be supportive. A couple of friends brought over meals for a couple of days, but that was, you know, that was about it. I really wish, honestly, that we could break some of the taboos about miscarriage, and that, you know, the way that the Relief Society brings dinners when somebody has a baby, we should be taking in dinners after somebody miscarries too. Physically it's different, but emotionally they need the break. And if it was, you know, if it was kosher to talk about it, to even call the Relief Society president and say, hey, you know what, we've had a miscarriage, can we have some support? I think I think that would be a really good thing. I think that culturally we're really scared to talk about death and loss and miscarriage, especially because it's really an invisible one. You know, most miscarriages happen early enough that you haven't seen the baby bump. You may not have known that they were pregnant. And so it's not very real to other people, I guess. The baby wasn't real, the pregnancy wasn't real, and so the loss isn't real, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. So I think... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Go ahead.
I just thought it was interesting. I mean, what you're talking about with some of the social stigmas around death and miscarriage in particular, it was interesting to me to hear your reaction during your second pregnancy, because I think a lot of times people will have that experience where they tell everybody and everybody knows, and then they have a miscarriage, and that's such a traumatic experience to go through, mm-hmm. that then the second time around they make sure and wait till they're, you know, 15, maybe even 20 weeks along before they'll tell anybody. And it sounds like for you, you chose the opposite approach, like, well, now I'm going to start telling everybody right from the beginning. So can you kind of talk me through what that decision was about for you?
Yeah. For me, the reason that I went that way, the second time around, I said, okay, you know, the first time I did all the stuff they say about waiting and whatever, and it didn't work out for me, so I'm going to do something different this time. And basically, I concluded that, you know, either you are pregnant or you're not, and if you are pregnant, then wouldn't you like to have people be happy for you and with you? And if something is going to happen, then it's going to happen, and there's, in, you know, in the majority of cases, there's not really something you could have done about it anyway. And so, you know, if I'm only going to be pregnant for a few weeks and then I'm going to miscarry, at the very least, I don't want to grieve alone again. I want people to know, and I want them to have known for as long as I have known, so that they can, I guess, relate more to the depth that I'm feeling. You know, they've had time to rejoice with me, and if the time comes to grieve, then they will be able to grieve with me. So that was where I came from, and I know that not every mother feels that way, but that was very much how I felt. And with my subsequent pregnancies, I have always shared on the early side.
So more this kind of concept of let's bear each other's burdens, and in order to mm-hmm. do that, we need to know what they are.
Yes.
We need to know yes. what our burdens are. Well, and also with what you said about, you know, bringing in meals and people not always understanding what
yes.
the emotional and physical stressors are. I mean, for instance, when you went through this experience with the heavy bleeding and all that, your body was recuperating, was needing to recuperate. It wasn't mm-hmm. just... And to your point, I don't know that people always know that. You know, it's almost like, mm-hmm. well, you're just expected to go on like normal and nothing has happened.
I have heard so many times the phrase that a miscarriage is just like a heavy period. And sometimes they are, particularly the very early ones. I've talked a lot with other women about at what point is that change from where it goes from being like a heavy period to where it becomes more like a labor and delivery. And the answers I got ranged from about 6 weeks to about 10 weeks. So, you know, there are some people who've been pregnant for 2 weeks and yet still have a labor and delivery experience. So, you know, it varies a lot from person to person, but I think that the medical establishment has done a great disservice with that phrase, it's just like a heavy period, because for a lot of people, it's not.
And you're saying that comes more from the medical community?
That's where I've heard it. Hmm. That was the sort of thing that they told me, even when I was 13 weeks pregnant and I had an ultrasound and there was no heartbeat, and they told me that the baby had died, and, you know, here's your options. We can do the DNC. You can go home and wait for the miscarriage to happen. It will probably be a heavy period. Mm-hmm. And because of my first experience, I said, no way am I going to go home and sit around and wait for this to happen. Let's just get this over with today. Mm-hmm. So... And like I said, after the fact, I felt kind of differently, because emotionally it had been a whole you know, different thing from what I had anticipated. But right, physically, so I think that was what I needed at the time.
Yeah, conflicting feelings about it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, so let's dive into, well, first of all, have I given you enough time to speak to your experience? Are there other experiences that you want to speak to us about before?
Well, I did want to sort of just, I've had a couple of other miscarriages besides those ones. And I had three of those sort of, you know, 12 to 15-ish week miscarriages prior to conceiving my first son who was, you know, who was, I carried to term. And then I did have another early miscarriage between my two boys. And so I have, you know, one adopted son and two biological sons, and four miscarriages. I think that I've probably had a couple of more that were just on the really early side, you know, kind of too early to get a test, but there was just something funky where it wasn't normal, and I really think that it was a miscarriage. I think that with earlier and earlier pregnancy identification, you know, the more and more sensitive tests, I think we're going to find that miscarriages are more and more common. The statistic right now is that about one in four pregnancies is a miscarriage. And I think that number might be surprising to a lot of people who think, oh, but I don't know anybody. And I think the truth is that you do know somebody and they've just never talked about it. If you have four friends, probably one of them is miscarried. If you know somebody who has more than four kids, she's probably miscarried. If you have more than four sisters, you know, you probably know people that have miscarried, even if they've never talked about it. Something that my mother told me and that I also experienced was that after my miscarriage, when I talked about it, people came out of the woodwork and said, yeah, me too. I've been there. Hmm. And that was something with that second miscarriage that, you know, when I did talk about it, a woman from my ward came over one afternoon, just showed up unannounced. I think she brought me dinner. I did not know her very well. And she came over and she brought me a little blanket that she had made, a little fleece blanket. And she told me that it was a hug, that I could, you know, wrap around me when I needed a hug. And she sat and talked with me for 2 hours about her miscarriages and my miscarriage and her experiences. And she was just there. And that was something that I really needed and something that I had very much been lacking the first time. And that's a role that I have tried to fulfill for other friends and family, as I have known other people who have miscarried. That's, you know, I've tried to come in and be that friend for them, the person who can bring them a hug and who can just sit and talk with them. So
I'm imagining that, I mean, you're having three miscarriages before you're able to carry a baby to term. I mean, at this point, are you just afraid you're never going to be able to have a child? Are you afraid there's something wrong with your anatomy? Are you getting consults from your physicians? What all is going on medically for you?
All of the above. After the first one, you know, which was just out of the blue, it was really a shock. The second time, I guess I should back up a little bit and clarify that I'm one of those people that believes that your body knows how to do what it's supposed to do. And so I leaned toward a very much more hands-off kind of approach. I'd been seeing a midwife the first time and that kind of thing. And so the second time I thought, okay, maybe it was something I did. I've heard that, you know, this food or that activity is maybe not totally safe. And so I maintained a really, really, really strict diet the second time. You know, I was just really careful about so many things. I had, you know, my however many grams of protein every day, and I was really sick with that pregnancy too, ironically. But after the second miscarriage, I said, okay, I have done everything that I can do on my own. And so with the third pregnancy, as soon as I suspected, I went in and I had them do a blood test. It was too early to even do the pee on a stick test. I went in and I had them do a blood test and they confirmed that I was pregnant. And I said, I want you to put me on all of the stuff that you put people on to make them not miscarry. And so I was on a progesterone supplement and I was on baby aspirin, which is something that they believe that some miscarriages are linked to clotting issues, and so it interrupts the flow of blood to the baby and prevents it from growing appropriately. And so the low dose aspirin is, you know, helps keep the blood going, and some people feel like it really makes a difference. And so I had, you know, I had my prescriptions and my aspirin and my progesterone, and I was very, very faithful with those. And, you know, and we did an ultrasound at 5 weeks, and here's a baby the size of a grain of rice, and you know, and we saw a heartbeat, and we were all excited because that was the first time we'd seen a heartbeat in 3 pregnancies. And then at 8 weeks, we went in again, and we didn't see a heartbeat. Mm. And so, you know, at that point, I really just reached a point of feeling like, there is nothing that I can do. There is nothing that doctors can do. There is nowhere left to go except to God. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, a lot of time crying and thinking and praying and trying to sort through things. And I can say that, you know, with the pregnancy where I did end up getting a baby out of it, I was very sort of emotionally, I guess, a little unbalanced through a lot of the early part, especially because I was really nervous about what could be or what might be, all of the what ifs. And I was very much aware that it was totally out of my control. And so I tried to just put everything in God's hands as much as I could. I prayed about which vitamins I should take. I mean, I really tried to do everything I could to seek the Spirit and to seek guidance about what I should do. And honestly, it was a very uncomplicated pregnancy. And going back, I mean, I had medical workups done and things, and there's no, in my case, there's no known medical reason for why I miscarried so many times. There's no explanation for why I had these crazy miscarriages and then had 2 really totally uncomplicated pregnancies. It's really very, very unknown. There's a lot about miscarriage, and most of it we don't understand. So
it sounds like this kind of this time that you were successful, you had really kind of drawn close to your relationship with God and seen that as your only kind of maybe buoy or whatever that was holding you mm-hmm. sane.
Yeah.
What if that would have also ended in a miscarriage? Do you think that would have affected your relationship with Heavenly Father or your Heavenly Parents,
you know,
or however you conceptualize that?
I know after the second loss, I was, you know, I was emotionally really struggling. And I remember, you're not supposed to, but I think we all do it. I remember trying to make a deal with God. And I said, look, I can't handle another one of these miscarriages. I can't do it. I really want to have kids. But if I'm not going to be able to carry to term, then don't let me get pregnant again, because I cannot deal with the whole miscarriage thing again. You know, little did I know. But when I got pregnant that next time, I really took it as a, you know, this is going to work out. I made this deal with God, so this is going to work out. And then at 8 weeks, I have this ultrasound that says your baby doesn't have a heartbeat. And I was sitting there thinking, but I had this deal, and this isn't how it's supposed to be. And so I went through a lot of, you know, the grief, the stages of grief. Anger is one of them. And I definitely went through a lot of anger at that point in trying to just cope with what was going on. I don't know. I think that if, you know, if things had gone wrong again, I probably, you know, I don't know how it might have affected my relationship with God or my testimony. I do know that a lot of people have said, well, how do you deal with, you know, you've had all these losses and all of these hard things, and how do you deal with it? And I've always said, you know, what else was I supposed to do? I was here, it was happening, and you have to press forward. You know, life goes on, and at some point you have to get, you know, you have to get back on your feet and go on.
Okay. So let's go to the piece about some of the social stigmas around miscarriage. You know, you talk a lot about people not mentioning the word, not knowing what to expect. You know, the first time you were miscarrying, you didn't even understand what was happening until it was really way obvious. And what's your experience about our silence around miscarriage, and what does that mean to you?
So I think that a lot of it is fear and discomfort, you know, with something unfamiliar and with something that I think grief makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And so I think there's a tendency to try to avoid it. Something that I found often was that people didn't relate to my need to grieve or for how long I needed to grieve. And I did hear people, and they were trying to be helpful, but comments like, you know, that it's, you know, it's been however long it's been, and that you should move on, you should focus on the child that you have, you should do these other things to distract you or to, you know, to draw your focus and to help you move on. And I felt like I needed to, I think I felt like my grief was more validated when I spent a little longer in it. There wasn't, you know, I didn't have a body to bury. I didn't have these other ways, you know, there was no grave to go visit or those kinds of things. And so the only way I had to remember or memorialize my baby or my pregnancy was to remember it and to, you know, to think about it and to grieve it for a while.
What's it like? And what's it like when people say those kinds of things, the move on type directives?
Well, you know, I'm the sort of person that has always been a little bit marched to my own drummer. And so I've generally just felt that, you know, they just don't understand and just, you know, leave me alone. I'm fine in terms of I'm dealing with this in the way I need to deal with it. I can imagine it being, you know, for someone of a different sort of personality, I can imagine there being guilt associated with the, oh, I should have moved on by now. Everybody tells me I should have moved on. Why haven't I moved on? What's wrong with me? Kinds of feelings, because, you know, we are very much influenced by our society and by what they tell us.
And one thing I think of too is possible anger. I mean, so you talk about guilt, and I wonder too if it just, you know, kind of fuels some anger and maybe even a feeling of isolation, like, well, I just need to stick by myself because obviously people don't understand, and there's not really a place to go and talk about this. And
yeah, yes, it was very isolating experience for me, and part of it even, I did have my husband, but his grief process was different from mine, and I think part of that is that men and women maybe grieve differently, but our experiences of the pregnancy had been different, and our grief was different, and we moved through stages at, you know, at different rates or in different ways. And so that was a difficult thing between us. Grieving a miscarriage can be really hard on a marriage.
Were you guys able to recognize that along the way, or was it now with hindsight that you can see, oh yeah, we were grieving differently? Was that something that was told to you? Were there any grief counselors available at these hospitals you were going at that would explain that to you, or?
I don't think anyone ever made that comment to me. At the time, I remember feeling frustrations that he didn't seem to appreciate how I felt, and that from my perspective that he wasn't grieving enough or wasn't grieving the right way. You know, I thought that he should be grieving more like me. In hindsight, I've been able to look back and realize that we were going through things in different ways and at different rates. But, you know, and that he was grieving too, and that it was just in a different way. You know, I remember after one of the losses that he watched. We had the extended Lord of the Rings, all three of the movies, and he just watched them back to back to back to back to back all day long. And it was kind of he just needed to sort of sit there and let his mind be completely distracted for a while. And that was a way that he coped. And I wanted to kind of wallow in it. I didn't want to be distracted. I wanted to think about it and talk about it and talk with other people about it. And at the time, you know, it was a difficult thing for me that, like I said, that we were grieving differently. But in retrospect, I can look back and realize that it was just that we each sort of found the way that we needed to deal with things. And it was just the difference between us that made it, you know, sort of extra difficult at the time.
So the original stages of grief are, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And mm-hmm. we, you know, obviously when there's any information given about grieving, whether it's miscarriage or death or whatever, mm-hmm. in whatever context, usually the stages of grief are brought up. How helpful were those stages mm-hmm. of grief for you? Like just knowing that that was kind of a developmentally correct thing to kind of go through, and were you expecting to go through them kind of in linear fashion, or did you understand that it was kind of more cyclical in nature, and were you surprised when you maybe had to revisit a stage?
Well, ironically enough, at the time, although I'd had classes and I'd learned about the stages, at the time I did not think about them at all. I was just in the middle of it and just sort of, you know, trying to keep my head above water from day to day. I've had, you know, a lot more time to process a lot of things since then, and time to, you know, to look at things and to realize, oh, when I was doing this, this was, you know, that was that phase kind of a thing. And actually, I did want to talk a little bit about the stages of grief. I put together, I've written a lot of things on my blog about a lot of these, you know, a lot of my experiences. And one thing that I did was that I wrote a post about some of, you know, what the grief cycles look like or can look like when applied to miscarriage. And actually, as I was looking up the stages of grief to make sure I had them all in order, I found that there are, the model has been expanded a little bit. And I don't know how common it is to use this expanded model, but I did think that it was helpful.
Yeah, no, there have been stages added. Like there's a seven-step process,
so I know. So the stages that I had were shock, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, testing, and acceptance.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love for you to speak about them.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. Shock is sort of, you know, the initial reaction. It's common to have the adrenaline kick in. It's overwhelming. You know, I remember my first miscarriage. I was supposed to be helping prepare something for an upcoming enrichment meeting, and I was supposed to meet with somebody else that evening. And so I remember as I'm laying there in the bathtub telling my husband, you need to call Sister So-and-so and tell her that I won't be there. And you need to call the midwife and tell her that I'm bleeding. And you need to call my mother and we need to get a babysitter for the other kid. But, you know, you've got to tell her I'm going to miss the appointment. And I'd had bread dough rising on the counter. And that night, I'm in the emergency room, you know, they're filling me with IVs and whatever, and I'm telling my husband, you've got to go home and get that bread cooked. That dough is going to be rising all over the counter. And I was really distressed about it. Hmm. I think, you know, the adrenaline just, and,
that you know, were taken with out adrenaline, of your kind of daily routine, that you were taken out of the things yeah. that you had expected to be doing that day.
Right. Right. And I was worried about them. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty normal thing for me in a fight or flight mode. I tend to get into to kick into high gear. But it can also be a fight or flight or freeze. For some people, they just, you know, they freeze up. They can't think. They can't do anything. They're not sure what to do. Sometimes they can't even cry. They're just stuck in the shock of it.
Right.
And I think really that's
like
common
that,
too.
Yeah, I really like that you mentioned that some people can't cry. I think that's actually a very normal response, not to necessarily cry right away when you're in shock. And then when people look back on that experience with hindsight, they feel guilty about that. They feel guilty that they didn't cry. How could I not have, you know, am I so callous? Am I so unfeeling or unemotional that I couldn't cry over this event? And I think it's good for women in particular in this situation, even men, to understand that that's actually a pretty normal response because you're in that protection mode of action. How am I going to act to save myself, you know, or that flight or fight, like you're saying?
So the next stage is denial. And I remember trying to convince myself that the baby didn't really die, that something was misdiagnosed, particularly in the cases where I had the diagnosis by ultrasound. With the third one, I went and got a second opinion. I went and had somebody else do another ultrasound. Particularly with the early ones, I went through, well, I wasn't really pregnant. I was wrong. I just, you know, I thought I was, but I must not have been. Sometimes there's the, oh, well, I'm starting to spot, but if I hurry and get, you know, this medication or this whatever, then it will be okay. It'll get fixed. And like I mentioned, you know, where my husband wanted distraction, I think that fits in with the denial that they just want to avoid thinking about it. They get busy doing something else. For me, I think denial manifested as wanting to get pregnant again immediately. Like as soon as I could, I wanted to get pregnant again. And kind of maybe if I get pregnant the very next month, then it will kind of be like it never happened.
Right.
So I think that all of those things are really normal. And for some people, it's they kind of want to pretend that they were never pregnant and they don't want to get pregnant again. They, you know, we're just going to kind of pretend this whole thing never happened. Mm. I think those are all really, really normal responses.
Right.
And obviously there's some opposites in there. And if you only know, you know, maybe one other person who's miscarried and you talk with them about their experience and you think, oh, but mine was opposite. Maybe I'm feeling something wrong. Maybe I'm weird. Maybe there's something wrong with me. I don't think so. I think it's just different personalities, different people, different deal with things in different ways.
Yeah, I'm hoping that if we get anything out of this whole thing, that would be our most underlying theme, is to allow yourself to go through this process in whatever way works for you. You know, that it's not I should or I shouldn't, or that I think we can learn from others, we can see patterns, but it's still going to be an individualized process.
Mm-hmm. So to just keep moving through the stages, in the anger stage, I personally experienced a lot of casting blame, a lot of, was there something that I did? Was there something that's wrong with me? In discussing this with other friends too, I think a lot of times it's, you know, was there something wrong with me? Was there something wrong with him? You know, my genes, his genes, was there something that I did or shouldn't have done? I went through a lot of feeling like my body was broken, or that I was broken because I was unable to perform this, you know, most basic female function, as it were. I remember being angry at anyone else in the world who had children or babies or was pregnant or who took that for granted or who had never lost a baby and just didn't get it or who was insensitive with me or who complained about a pregnancy or complained about their kids because they didn't appreciate how good they had it. So I hated almost everybody for a while. Because, you know, they didn't know how lucky they were. And I just wanted to, you know, I just wanted to say, look, you have a kid. And, you know, that was, for me, that was how my anger manifested, but I think it can go a lot of directions. Sometimes people are angry at the baby, sometimes they're angry at God, you know, like I said, at themselves or at their spouse or at just about anybody or everybody. When I started bargaining, you know, I mentioned I tried to make a deal with God you know, the don't let me get pregnant again if I'm just going to miscarry kind of thing. I've known people who have felt sort of disgruntled by their marriage. You know, maybe if I had a different spouse, things might have gone differently. You know, and in a really literal sense, that procreating with a different partner might not have led to a miscarriage. But also that, you know, if we had, you know, this or that was different, if we had the different doctor or the different, you know, if we had more money or, you know, if this or that or the other was different, then things might not have gone the way they went. And I've known several couples that following miscarriage somewhere along the way, they did have struggles with their marriage. Just, you know, and maybe it was the discrepancy in how they grieved, but I think sometimes there was anger directed at each other and also feelings of the what ifs. You know, what if something had been different? And the spouse is one of those things that, you know, maybe could have, if something had been different about the spouse or with the spouse. And I think that's an important thing to realize. I do know one couple that divorced not very long after a miscarriage. And I remember talking with her at the time and saying, you know, if I understand that there's stuff going on, but I think right now is not the time to do this. If you guys feel like this is what's going to happen, at least give it some time, because you just miscarried a couple months ago. And I think right now is not a good time to make this kind of decision because you're still grieving.
Right.
I think it's really normal to have, you know, the grief over the miscarriage manifest itself in some kind of interesting ways, and to realize that, you know, a certain amount of frustration or anger, you know, with other relationships is probably a natural part of the process. And, you know, don't be too hasty about things. Right. Because...
No, I think that's really good advice.
Things move on.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, and I know that there's statistics, and I don't have them in front of me, but I know that there's statistics about when a child dies in a marriage, so this mm-hmm. is a child that, you know, was born, and I'm not talking about
right.
miscarriage,
right.
that the statistics are actually quite high that the couple will end up divorced because they can't get over mm-hmm. either the blame of the other person or... you know, just it's just such a difficult thing to go through. So many couples mm-hmm. Just really find it hard to continue together. It's just too painful to be together mm-hmm. after a child dies. I don't know if you're aware of any. Are you aware of any statistics after miscarriage? Or
I'm not. My, you know, I say this primarily based on, you know, friends and acquaintances and other people that I've talked with who have been down the road and said, you know, our marriage struggled in the however long after the miscarriage that was, you know, that was, it's definitely unfortunate that so often comes hand in hand with, you know, with the grief and, oh my goodness, now my marriage is struggling too. But I think it is really normal, just sort of part of the process.
Well, and again, if couples are told that to expect this and to understand that this is part mm-hmm. of the process, I think they're better equipped anyway to ride the waves, you know, versus
yes.
just being, you know, just shocked that in the time of their most grief that their loved one isn't there to grieve with them in the precise exact way that they had hoped or wanted. And I think that's mm-hmm. the disappointment that many times draws couples apart, is that, well, mm-hmm. you know, I thought you knew me, or I thought you loved me, or if you loved me, you would know what this means to me, or you would grieve in this way with me. And those are all very kind of unrealistic ways to approach grief. And again, I think it just takes education and knowledge about what you've said several times now, which is people grieve in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the importance of that. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
So the next stage in the grief cycle is depression. And it's, this for me manifested with a lot of lethargy. It wasn't exactly that I was feeling sad. I think it's more accurate to say that I was feeling nothing. I was sort of withdrawn from things. I think some people feel guilty over being happy about anything, as though maybe it indicates a lack of love for the child that was lost. And so they might, you know, avoid social activities that might possibly be happy or fun. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of weird, but I've watched it and I've experienced it.
Makes sense to me.
I also found that, you know, I would have these moments of happiness, little things that were fun or that I enjoyed or that were humorous or whatever it was. But when it came down to, you know, the end of the day or honestly even at any given point in the day, if I sat down and consciously tried to think of when was the last time I smiled, what was something I was happy about, I couldn't think of things. And this was something where my husband was a huge help for me. At one point, we instated a practice that every night before bed, he would sit down with me and he would help me think of one thing that day that I could be happy about. And I think about it now and that seems sort of cheesy, but it made a huge difference because on the average day, I needed help to think of one thing to have been happy about. So
almost that permission given, that permission that it's mm-hmm. it's okay to also have both feelings, right? It's almost like people will say, mm-hmm. well, if I feel happy, then I don't feel grief. Whereas we can feel the grief and feel the joy that comes in day-to-day activities and that one doesn't mm-hmm. have to invalidate the other.
Mm-hmm. The final stages are the testing and acceptance. And testing is sort of the attempts at acceptance where you sort of think you're moving out and you're trying it and then you sort of fall flat on your face and you know it takes multiple tries and some of them are just epic fails. But ultimately, you know, you find a place where you settle into a new normal. I think sometimes people expect life to somehow go back to the way it was before. And it's not going to go back to the way it was before. Any kind of wound is going to leave a scar. And so it's going to be a new and a different kind of normal. But, you know, eventually a point does come where you can get things done and you can live life. You can hear pregnancy announcements or see pregnant women or hold other people's babies and not completely lose it. You can look back at the loss without fixating on it. And some people talk about closure, but I think it's broader than that because it's not closing the book on what happened. It's validating it and accepting it and moving forward anyway. And it has been, let me think, it has been 7 years since my first loss. My three biggest losses were all within about a 2-year period. So it's been 5 years since then. And, you know, there was a long time when I frequently would just sort of drop into a day of just not really sort of being incapacitated just by thinking about remembering. And, you know, I have moments like that, but it's more likely to be a few minutes now rather than a few hours or a day. And it's little things like maybe meeting a child who's the age that my baby would have been, some of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's looking at my kids and wondering how our family might have been different if we'd had, you know, one of those other babies in the mix, if we had a baby of, you know, of that other age. But in the long run, I think I've adjusted and I'm coping. Coping's not a daily process like it was early on. And maybe it's partly because I had multiple losses, but it took me several years to really move through. For several years every time I had the anniversary of a miscarriage date or the anniversary of a due date, I was just a wreck, and I kind of learned to just expect that. And, you know, earlier this year or last year, I don't remember, I remember looking at the calendar and thinking, oh, that anniversary was last week. And I had completely, you know, not noticed. I had moved on. Hmm. And I've learned to not feel guilty about that, to realize that that's, you know, that's something where I've moved on, and that's okay, and I can focus on where I am now. And it's not that I've forgotten what happened, but that I can live in the present. And it does take time, but it does come.
You can still honor that child and that experience without having to pay the, you know, those minute details homage. Well, I love this concept of the new normal. I love that, and I love your ideas about closure maybe not being the appropriate term, meaning, you know, when we close something, meaning we're not going to reopen it, but something that kind of stays, you know, within our realm and within our experience, but that we've now have a new experience with, you know, a new relationship with that experience. So I like those concepts. I think those are very accepting concepts of what it is like for a lot of people moving in these directions. And I guess another thing I want to talk about is you did a really good job of explaining what each one of those stages kind of looks like. And I do like to just validate that for some people those are very linear type experiences, and for others they kind of go back and forth between those stages, and I think that's normal. And I think what was most helpful about listening to you say all that was the time involvement. And so when you hear people kind of let, you know, telling you to just move on, or it's been enough time, or boy, it's been 3 weeks since that happened, you know, it just I think really diminishes or minimizes this process that it takes to go through something like this successfully.
I think part of the reason that people maybe don't really understand is that when there is, you know, an older person, regardless of whether it was a small child or an older person, there's a lot more social process surrounding the death. There's, you know, there's a funeral, there's a burial, there's more community, I guess, relation to the event. And so with a miscarriage, it's usually a much more private thing. It's, you know, it's the woman, you know, maybe just alone at home, or, you know, or with her husband, maybe involvement with, you know, with the doctor or whatever, but it's not the kind of thing where there's a big social involvement, and so people don't relate to it in the same way because they weren't part of the event, if that makes sense. And so it's sort of like me telling someone about something that I did, you know, back when I was in college, with people that they didn't know and situations that they didn't know. They can say, oh, well, that was really great, or that was really sad, or, you know, they can express the appropriate words, but they don't really feel it because they don't really relate, because they don't connect to it. And I think that that's a common difference between a miscarriage versus loss of an older person, you know, of whatever age, because the society doesn't relate because they were not part of the experience of the miscarriage.
Right. There's no ritual. There's no social gathering. There's no social, recognition, right, that, that something of import has happened here that we all need to pay attention to. Right.
And for me, that was a big part of my grief, too, was that I needed some recognition and some validation. You know, this was a huge thing for me, and I was grieving, and I needed other people to recognize that it was a huge thing. I needed them to say, yes, talk to me about it. I needed them to, you know, I didn't need them to do much except just let me talk. For me, that was something that was very cathartic for me, was to talk. But, you know, but I needed them to acknowledge my baby, basically. So.
Well, let's segue then into, if you're okay with, doctrinal issues at this point. I think that there's a lot of, you know, things that are maybe, I think most of what you've spoken of right now relates to, I think, anyone who's going through miscarriage. But I think there's specific Mormon things that also should be talked about. I think there's such a prevalent importance on motherhood within the Mormon, you know, culture and doctrine. And so, for instance, whenever I come across a client that has been, has either experienced miscarriage, well, yeah, let's just stay there, It's very difficult for me not to find underlying tenets of guilt, worthiness, even issues. In other words, I think as Mormons, we have this mentality that if we do good, we'll be blessed. And when we don't do good, we're not blessed, right? These are the very kind of classic equational type thought processes and that we're given at church.
Good righteous Mormons, yeah. And right. Good righteous Mormons multiply and replenish. And so if I was doing everything right, God would be sending me babies.
Right. And I find this almost, I mean, this is like, I would say almost 100% of the women that I've worked with around these issues, there's definitely a sense of, even if it's not completely intellectual, like even if they know intellectually, yeah, that's probably not the case, there's still some emotional commitment to that idea of there really must have been something that I did, or they're guilty about something, you know, in their past. Maybe they had premarital sex, maybe they had premarital, maybe not even sex, but just fooling around, or maybe they weren't a good enough daughter, whatever. I mean, I could tell you 300,000 things that women come up with as reasons why they are now experiencing these types of either infertility or miscarriage. I see that very common.
I think that, and it's probably worth noting that miscarriage can sort of be a form of infertility. There are people who miscarry and miscarry and miscarry and don't ever carry to term. Mm-hmm. And so people say, oh, well, at least you're getting pregnant. Well, yeah, you know what? That doesn't mean a whole lot.
Right.
And for a couple of years, that was where I was. And I had people say, oh, well, at least you're getting pregnant. And I thought, yeah, well, I think I'd rather not get pregnant than, you know, get pregnant and lose over and over.
Right.
You know, you mentioned the guilt, and I think part of the reason we tend to do that is that we don't have a physical explanation. You know, 95% of miscarriages, we don't really know why they happen. And so, you know, here's this unexplained bad thing, and I think it's really natural to try to look for a reason, and if we can't find a physical reason, then we figure there must be some kind of, you know, spiritual one. It's some kind of, you know, I don't know, karmic payback. You know, I did something bad, which is why this bad thing is happening to me. So I think that's probably pretty normal. And even though we can intellectually say, oh, well, that's not rational, I think it's still, I would agree that that's pretty normal.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, charred and calm, came from thee, Jesus Savior, pilot me, unknown ways before me roll, hiding rock, and treacherous shore. Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus Savior.